Hello, my name is Chip Bling, and you are listening to Total EM. We are back this week to talk about something that recently came up on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine, because I went on that podcast for podcast number 249, check it out, where we did a deep dive on a paper, a systematic review, and a meta-analysis that was recently published. And it talked all about ultrasound to confirm endotracheal tube placement. You may be asking yourself, okay, didn't you talk about this on your own podcast a while back? Why are we revisiting this? And that is true. In podcast number 118, we talked all about the technique and some different papers, not just the one that was covered on the SGM. But I still want you to listen to the SGM, because unlike the previous podcast, we went into a much deeper review about that actual paper. And I think it's probably one of the best papers that's out right now. So it's definitely one to check out for that reason. So then you may ask, well, why are you talking, Ben, about how to confirm endotracheal tube placement with ultrasound? And I would again say that's a fair question. But after the last post and publishing on that and getting some feedback around with the SGM, I realized that maybe we got a little ahead of ourselves, and maybe we need to take a step back and talk a little more about the basics, because apparently a lot of people are a little annoyed that we are doing some things that they think may be too advanced or maybe something that's not necessary. And I would disagree, but I'm going to break this down a little bit into a quick series of arguments to further discuss this, which is why this podcast is all about confirming endotracheal tube placement in general. So as a quick recap, it's not only vital that we accurately identify endotracheal tube placement, but we do so quickly, because anytime that we inaccurately place the tube, we risk complications as a result. And that is the big one, desaturation, which can eventually lead to cardiac arrest. Well, yeah, we can do different methods to eventually confirm that endotracheal tube placement, but if we don't do it quickly, then it's pointless. We're opening ourselves up to all sorts of problems. So let's talk about some of the key ones that we hear about. First off is direct visualization. Direct visualization is one that it seems like a lot of people have said, well, if I can see it directly go in, then that means it's perfect and I've taken care of it. But if I could only tell you the number of times that I've heard someone say that they could see it go through the cords, and then guess what? The tube isn't actually in the trachea as promised, then I would be able to take care of that argument one fell swoop, because I've been able to see that many times. And I know that I'm not the only one who sees this phenomenon. So I think we have to be realistic. Yes, it works 100% of the time if you're right 100% of the time. If you're not right 100% of the time, then it's not a perfect technique. Quit calling it that. It is not perfect. And then let's talk about the times when, even with your best foot forward, you still cannot always directly see what you are trying to go for. So if you can't see the cords and you have one of those difficult grade intubations, then you can't definitively say just by direct visualization, even with the hyperangulated VL scopes like I tend to use, you still are going to be in a situation where this doesn't always work. So quit saying it does, because unless you are perfect every single time and you have multiple people to back that up, can you really be certain? No, I don't think you can. So quit calling this 100% technique, because it is not 100%. Simple as that. Moving on to the next one, auscultation. Auscultation sucks for a number of reasons. It can be misleading when you hear the sounds, just like with pneumothorax, because sometimes you could be wrong just by auscultating and not hearing correctly. In a loud environment, you may not be able to hear it at all. For example, in a helicopter, you're not going to hear anything. Auscultation is absolutely useless. I do encourage, if you are going to do auscultation, to listen over the epigastrium first and listen for bubbles. If you are lucky enough to hear that, then great. You know that you're probably in the wrong spot and you need to pull out. But a lot of times what happens is that you get multiple breaths because you're not certain and everything else is going on, the commotion, and you're trying to check out other things to help confirm you all at the same time. Next thing you know, you've pumped that stomach full of air. So by the time you do decide to pull out, guess what? All that gastric distension, it's going to go somewhere and it goes back. So I really do not like auscultation. I think it's one of those that you can use when you're in a pinch and you can just tack that off in the boxes, but it's not one that is super helpful. Okay, so what about pulse ox? Well, pulse ox is kind of good, but really in a lot of critical patients, it could be delayed for a long time. We're talking about a minute or so. And so that pulse ox lag is not going to be super helpful. Now, even in a patient with healthy lungs, then if they get main stems, especially in these young, healthy people, it can take a while for the oxygen saturation to dip. And when you get to that point, you're way behind. And now you're troubleshooting because you're not exactly sure if that's really the cause. So pulse oximetry is really not that great for quick, accurate information to confirm our endotracheal tube placement. Okay, well, if we can't do that, then what about chest x-ray? Well, chest x-ray is nice if you went like a little more definitive and quote-unquote gold standard of placement, but I'm not a huge fan of that because in many cases that we're doing endotracheal intubation, we're not able to drop the tube, pop the chest x-ray, and then look at the placement then. It takes time. And a lot of times you have to call radiology over. And, you know, if we especially have CPR ongoing, we can't really confirm endotracheal tube placement then because ultimately there's a delay in that as well. And what we are doing, if we are trying to do it during the middle of a code, is we're taking more time off that chest. So we're decreasing the high quality CPR, the thing that's really going to make a difference. So again, I'm really not a fan of the chest x-ray. It is nice to eventually get to help confirm your placement, but it should not be your first line. And I don't really think anyone is trying to do it first line. If you are, you're way behind the times. You need to do something else that could be at least better. Okay, this is one that I'll admit, I'm not even sure if I've ever used before. And that's esophageal intubation detectors, which is usually this bulb type of thing, or alternatively, the little lights that you can use to help confirm endotracheal tube intubation. I've seen them before, and I know I've practiced on them, but I don't think I've ever used it in a real situation because usually in the resources and environments I'm working at, this is something that we don't even have. And really, I think it adds more steps without really fixing the ultimate issue. And usually you're using it as a second or third line thing because you have other reasons why you're not certain. So I would rather have something more reliable up front than just another tool that I got to dig out of somewhere if I even have it at all. Okay, so let's talk about something that's a little more, again, quote unquote, gold standard. And that's end-tidal CO2 detection. This is usually continuous waveform capnography, colorimetric, or non-waveform capnography. It seems to be the one that is the hot one, I'd say, right now. Waveform capnography, yes, out of all of them is the best, although a lot of us have the color change still, especially in the rural or pre-hospital environments because it's quick, easy to pop on. And it seems like it usually gets used first, even though really, if we're going to use something, waveform is a lot better. But you can still have false positives, especially if you're vigorously using a BVM and you've got a lot of oxygen in the stomach, you can still get this like CO2 exchange in there going on where it gets kind of mislabeled and misplaced. The next thing you know, you're still wrong. And then in codes, as we've talked about before, it can be very inaccurate. You're talking about like 65% of the time it's correct, but that means that another third of the time it's wrong. So end-tidal CO2, although a lot of people want to make that argument as well, it's not perfect either. So I really don't think we can use this one as, again, a standalone. Now, some people are liking to say, well, I did direct visualization and then I did end-tidal CO2. That could be acceptable. I'm not saying that it's not, but I think it's something that we can't say is a perfect combination in of itself. And I would highly encourage that we at least consider alternatives. And that's why it comes to finally my original point in all this is point of care ultrasound. Using POCUS addresses pretty much all these problems. So it's fast. It's a lot faster than chest x-ray, and it is faster than end-tidal CO2, especially with the recent study on the SGM where we talked about this. It could be up to 4 times faster. It's incredible in that regard, and it's very sensitive and specific in regards to the placement, which beats out everything else. I like how in the dynamic setting where I can dynamically scan and say someone else is actually intubating the patient, I am then looking with the ultrasound. I can tell them right away, hey, you're in the wrong spot. No, I can see it go through the cords. Guarantee you, you're not seeing the cords. You are doing an esophageal intubation. I can do that with the ultrasound in real time versus waiting and telling them, I think you're wrong. And then we play this game for the next minute or two where, oh crap, we actually are wrong. We're trying to go backwards in time and fix everything, which guess what? Doesn't go very well. So please realize that there is a role, especially dynamically. Let's say you can't do a dynamic. Okay, have the machine already warmed up, ready to go. And as soon as you finish placing the tube and you've got it like help with securing it, then put your ultrasound probe over, look over the trachea, see that it's in place. Now, if you want some real bonus points in doing stuff that really only a few other things can claim to do, such as chest x-ray, look at lung sliding before and after you intubate. If the lung sliding is the same on both sides before and after, most likely you have it in the correct position. And that is something that I really like to do. I try and do this a lot more, especially because it seems like a lot of times radiology takes forever to come over, take a chest x-ray. So I always worry about, could I have potentially main stemmed? And I really, really try and avoid that by my technique, but I can't guarantee it. So I like to be able to see that lung slide before and after and say, hey, it's in good position. Now, if I can only do it after for whatever reason, at least it's something, but I like the before and after because you may realize that one side already slides a little bit less and you can compare it as a before and after type of thing. Again, most of this is qualitative versus a quantitative way that we're going to tell this, but with experienced hands, which basically all you have to do is do this exam and you get experience over it, and you will realize that this is pretty straightforward. This is not a hard exam to do. Like most point of care exams, when we're doing this ultrasound study, it is very simple. It is very straightforward. It is very easy to teach. And then I have a couple other things that came up. I'm not specifically mentioning them from the blog side of things. I'm talking about it more in the podcast directly. One thing that really annoyed me is people kept saying, well, the cost of everything. You can now get an ultrasound machine for less than $2,000. This is with Butterfly. I don't think it's a surprise to anyone because you mentioned it before. But even if you get other pocket ultrasounds, you're talking about anywhere from $2,000 to $10,000 for most of them. That's incredibly inexpensive, a lot less expensive than a lot of the equipment that we're using out there, especially when we're talking about radiological studies. So let's not make this an excuse. I mean, you can personally buy this if you really wanted to and be able to use it. So ultrasound is something that we should have in the department. I think that's one of those things that it has so many different uses. We really should all be using ultrasound at this point. And I think very quickly we're going to realize that it's becoming more and more of a quote standard of care, end quote. Although I hate using that term for a lot of things, I think this is realistically what we're coming to. And we need to understand that ultrasound has a lot of applicability across the board. The other big thing that I had some surprising pushback on was from the anesthesiology side of things, which really surprised me because anesthesia, I know, and I can link this into the show notes if need be, but with like the ultrasound podcast, for example, they interviewed a pediatric anesthesiologist. It's like, yeah, I love using ultrasound for this because of some of the things that you can do with ultrasound. So in kids, it can be very difficult to innovate. If you haven't done many pediatric innovations, if at all, the real challenge is not just getting the tube in, but getting in too deep. Pediatric anesthesia is used to this issue. So what do? They purposely main stem at first, and they fluid fill the balloon. So they use saline, and they can track it back with using the ultrasound until they get to the right place in the trachea. They'll see that fluid. It kind of swirls around a little bit. They help confirm that is in place. Then they take the fluid out, replace it with air, and they're all the while assessing for lung sliding on the both sides as well. And holy cow, you've done everything. You didn't main stem this kid. You're oxygenating them well and appropriately. And you did it all without having to do some other modality to help confirm your placement. Very quick, very easy. So don't tell me that anesthesia doesn't see the purpose in this. Some people do. You just haven't been exposed to it yet. Like I said, I'm not trying to push anyone necessarily into ultrasound. I just want you to at least think about it and quit closing your minds off. It's horrible to go through these discussions where people walk in with this automatically believing one thing when the evidence is really showing that otherwise it is a beneficial tool and that we should be using this more. And if you need help with learning this, there are lots of places to go. As we've talked about before, Practical POCUS has courses. There are plenty of workshop type courses to do this type of stuff in, but that's beside the point. It's easy to learn, just like any ultrasound exam. We just have to take the steps to learn it in the first place. And that's all I'm asking for, is just at least consider this and be open to new ideas and concepts. But until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.